we romanticized this whole idea that this part of this was going to suck. Like, we'd hear everybody talk about, oh yeah, you get 100 pounds on your back. It's terrible. You know, it's like, in a way we said to ourselves, because we know it's going to be terrible, it's going to be fine.
Right.
And we didn't really realize that, no, it was going to suck.
Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry Podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. Straight and to the point, no fluff, no BS. This show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast and our backcountry hunting packs, please visit exomountaingear.com. Well, welcome to episode 65. This is going to be a great one, guys. We are essentially interviewing you, or probably someone just like you. So we love getting the big names on the show and picking the brains of the experts, if you will. But this show is all about just a regular do-it-yourself hunter. The guest is Matt Gray. He's a Texas resident who hunted out of state on a Western backpack elk hunt for the first time in 2016, and was fortunate enough to tag a bull. But even if he didn't, killing the bull isn't really why he's on this show. This show is all about, what did Matt learn? So, some things went great on Matt's trip, some things didn't go as planned. I just love hearing Matt's perspective as a new beginner, hearing about what gear issues he had, what lessons he found valuable, what information wasn't so valuable, how he prepared physically. So this is going to be incredibly helpful for you guys, especially if you are a newer hunter. We are just super excited to kind of cap this beginner's basics series we've been doing with this great discussion from Matt. Even if you're further along in your hunting journey, you're certainly going to be entertained, inspired, and probably still learn a thing or two from this episode. So we are excited that you guys are joining us for this one. In our conversation, Matt mentions a resource that he found incredibly valuable. And it's a resource that we've talked about before, months ago, really before the 2016 seasons kicked off. And that is the University of Elk Hunting online course from our friends at Elk 101. Just wanted to remind you guys to go check out this course. And in fact, if you do, you can save 40% by using the keyword backcountry, all one word, backcountry, the University of Elk Hunting online course. It is the most comprehensive and complete elk hunting resource ever. And that's the tagline that they use. But honestly, after reviewing it, after looking for elk hunting materials in my own journey over the past, you know, 5+ years, it's absolutely true that this is the most comprehensive and complete resource. If I would have had this 5 years ago, oh man, I would have saved so much time in the research that I tried to gather and the lessons that I tried to learn, because essentially it's a one-stop shop. So if you guys are interested in that and interested in growing as an elk hunter for 2017, go to elk101.com/online course. You can use the keyword backcountry, again, all one word, and save 40% on that course. I know that that investment will pay off for you guys in the seasons to come. Also, one more thing. I feel like we're throwing a lot of things out there at you guys, but we want to welcome First Light as a sponsor and partner for this podcast. Steve and I have been using First Light's gear for years. Way back when we started using First Light, it was essentially only their merino wool layers, which we still use and love. But as you might know, First Light over the years has added outerwear pieces, rain gear, and other performance items to help you go farther and hunt longer. We are super excited about some of the pieces that First Light has come out with for 2017, including their new pattern, Cypher. If you guys haven't seen it yet, it is a great looking pattern, and we are excited to get it in the field. In fact, we have 2017 First Light gear on a FedEx truck headed to us right now, and can't wait to begin testing that and giving you guys feedback on what we're liking for the 2017 lineup. So big thanks to First Light. They are not only producers of amazing quality gear that helps us hunt more effectively, but they are true partners and advocates for conservation, and we just love everything that they stand for. All right, here's this week's show with Matt Gray. I know that you guys will enjoy this one.
All right, guys, well, welcome to the podcast. Steve, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fantastic.
Yeah. And Matt, you are a listener who we flipped the script on you, and you are now being on the show. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, doing great. We had nice warm weather here, 70-degree day in Texas.
Very nice. Yeah, kind of jealous of that. We actually got a touch of warmth this past weekend. It was phenomenal to get outside, but now it's cooling back off. So
you guys are lucky. It's like 16 degrees and a foot of snow in my yard. So.
Do you still have all that snow hanging around, Steve?
Yeah, it has not left. It's a crazy winter here.
Have you guys got any more? It just hasn't been warm enough to kind of melt off.
No, it was like 4 or 5 inches just today.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's
crazy. You guys getting hammered.
Yeah, it's record snow here.
For not being at elevation.
No.
Goodness.
Yeah, it's starting to get a little worried about how the elk and deer herds are going to do through this.
No joke. Wow. Yeah, I heard it's getting a ton of snow up Tyler's way, too, up on the mountain.
Yep.
Yeah, dang. All right, well, Matt, so glad to have you on the show. I'm super excited about this one, excited to have you on. And, you know, just for the listeners, I mean, this is going to be a phenomenal show because we hear from so many guys who are in your shoes or, you know, are getting ready to make a trip like you have made this past year. But before we dive into specifics, just go ahead and give us context on a little bit of your hunting background and then what led up to this trip last year. Where did you go? What did you hunt? And what's your hunting history?
Okay, sure. Let's see. I started hunting since I was very little. My dad here in Texas, mostly whitetail hunting and pigs and spring turkey and things like that. But I've been in a deer stand, I guess, for as long as I can remember. I did have a break away from it, though, in like late high school and college. I got into rodeo and like team roping, and it was kind of tough to do both. But a few years ago when I got married, I kind of had to choose just one. And I chose hunting just because that was definitely my passion continue to whitetail hunt, different, you know, stuff that Texas has to offer. And, but I think it was about 3 years ago, I had a buddy that, from church that I met that, had just come back. It was September and he had just come back from Colorado and was telling me about this horrible hunt he had and how it's been his third year going. And he still, has hardly even seen an elk. But he can't wait to go again the next year.
I was going
to
say, he was telling you about this horrible hunt that he can't wait to do next year. I'm sure that's
exactly
how it goes. Yeah.
Yep. And so that kind of got the spark going in me, and I started doing research. And, yeah, about 3 years ago, I decided I wanted to go. And then we went to one income with me and my wife, and I just didn't see it happening at that upcoming September. So I didn't buy any gear. I didn't do anything. And then here came September around and him and a few other guys were going and I just was going, oh my gosh, you know, I could have made it happen. And so then I said, next year, you know what, I'm going to pick a date. And that was September 2017 or 2016, excuse me. And, I said, I don't care what kind of gear I have, how good it is, how bad it is or what, but I'm going to go elk hunting. And I was planning on going to Colorado over the counter units, but it almost didn't happen because we ended up getting pregnant and we had our first baby girl in May that year.
Oh, wow.
So I thought that was going to wipe out my leave balance at work and things, but luckily I was able to make it work. And then that summer I had a few different partners that I was kind of juggling with. They were supposed to be going with me and things just didn't work out. And me and Isaac met that spring and started hanging out and shooting our bows together. And I just said, hey, you know what? You're twice my age, but you're in shape. And I'm going on this deal. And I know it's last minute notice, but would you want to go? Could you get all the gear together? And he said, I'll do it. And
awesome.
So, yeah,
was it
last
just,
September,
it was just the two of you then?
It was just the two of us. Now, we had two other guys that were kind of going with us from the same area, but we only were really even around each other like once or twice, and we never really hunted together. And I gave them some of the spots I had kind of researched, but most time, you know, we didn't have service out there, and it was hard to, you know, coordinate anything and figure out where they were. Yeah. But for the most part, it was me and Isaac.
Right. So we discussed back and forth, and you know, you weren't asking to be on the show. I kind of asked you to be on the show once I heard your story, and then I asked you, like, what are some of the things that you found most helpful or would find most helpful to share with the listeners? And you sent me an awesome list of stuff, and on that list, since you mentioned it, was hunting partners. And you specifically said, you know, like, when it comes to hunting partners, you need to make sure that you and your partner that you're equally prepared, have similar expectations. And then you even mentioned if you had gone on this trip with the original partner you were planning on, that both you and that partner would have had a horrible hunt. So why would that have been a horrible hunt? And then why did going with Isaac work well? Kind of talk a little bit about the dynamics of partnership and what you learned on this first trip.
Yeah, well, I'm thankful the way it worked out, the way it did, because me and Isaac just hunted great together. But yeah, originally I had this one partner who was not even very experienced in hunting, period. He had shot just one or two deer before, and then just barely I got him to pick up a bow that fall before and let him shoot a buck that I was watching. So his first animal with a bow ever was about 150-inch whitetail.
Oh, nice.
That was nice. But I took him there to shoot a much smaller deer, and this came out. he was ahead of me in the family starting. He had a daughter who was turning two, and he was he worked a lot. When he got home late, left super early in the morning. So he didn't have time to, you know, I try to call him and plan stuff and schedule stuff, or just say, hey man, I'm excited about this piece of gear. I've been researching this or looking at this. And, you know, he didn't have a whole lot of time to do that. And I got very passionate about it. Very obsessive about research. I just loved it all, the whole process of planning and everything. And I'd get excited about it, and he necessarily wasn't there. And then when I started trying to get in shape, the little that I did, he just didn't have time. And I think our intensity levels too, when it came to the actual hunt, my goal, even though I knew I was trying to keep it in check, because I knew I was a first time ever Western, over the counter tags and very popular units in Colorado, that the chances of me getting an elk were extremely small. But I was dead set. You know, I always heard the rule about that 90% of the elk are killed by 10% of the hunters. And I said, I want to be in the 10%. And so I was very intense about it, and he wasn't. And so I feel if we would have actually hunted together, he wouldn't have been able to keep up. I wouldn't have been able to go some of the places that I wanted to go. It just, the chemistry wouldn't have worked out. And yeah. So it was kind of a godsend that fell through in a way, and that me and Isaac got paired up together because we were perfect.
Yeah.
Do you feel physical fitness played a big role in your hunt?
Oh, huge.
Huge? Yeah.
Especially into the enjoyment of the hunt. I think a lot of it, too, is we romanticized at listening to all these podcasts like this one, all these YouTube channels, and seeing all these very experienced people that live out there in the West like you do, Steve, and they get to do this all the time and live in the mountains. And we live in hills, but it's still nothing like up there and no elevation to speak of. We romanticized this whole idea that this part of this was going to suck. Like, we'd hear everybody talk about, oh yeah, you get 100 pounds on your back. It's terrible. You know, but it's like, in a way we said to ourselves, because we know it's going to be terrible, it's going to be fine.
Right.
And we didn't really realize that, no, it was going to suck.
And, genuinely so, terrible, like, yeah.
Yeah, definitely terrible. And I, like I say, our first day, for example, our first day actually hunting, oh, we gassed ourselves. We thought that we could go anywhere, do anything. We dropped down into some lost serious elevation at times, just to have to gain them back to go back to where we were. Mm-hmm. And like we gassed ourselves so much on the first day that we had to take almost a whole day off just because we weren't ready for that. And we didn't really know what we were doing. And so even though that was it was great for me and Isaac to be on the same page when it came to our physical fitness and intensity of the hunt, we still want to be much more prepared next year.
Yeah. I was just going to ask, what are some of the things you did to prepare? Was it kind of like, you know, just going for runs, things like that? Were you lifting? And then how are you going to prepare, you know, differently this year physically?
Okay. I guess now that I think about it, it was very mild. I'd walk with my wife and the baby around the block a few times with a pack, and I put, you know, 50 pounds in it or something. I maybe occasionally me and Isaac would go somewhere and do a couple of miler, but still around here, the most elevation gain and loss we can get is 50 or 60 feet, normally. And it was nothing that was ever really intense, no program, nothing telling us to push it even harder. And because we didn't really know what to expect, we didn't know to push it even farther. But this next year, we are definitely going to try to be more prepared. Isaac and his wife, they work out a whole lot. And so he's changed the way he works out to be much quicker pace stuff, more. Isaac, what kind of stuff are you doing?
Well, I mean, we weight train, you know, several days a week, but, you know, we've set days aside that are set just mainly for cardio. And, you know, just putting miles on our feet when we can.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But we learned, you know, what I learned from that hunt is that, you know, the reality was, is going in there in public land and, to take an animal that's under the pressure that they are, there's a price to pay. And, you know, you got to go back in there and, it was a little suffer fest to get the prize. But the moment that we got back after, experiencing that, you know, I've started training for the next hunt after I had recuperated, from our first trip. And,
we don't want to be in as much pain as we did last year. I started, there's a local CrossFit gym and a lot of your listeners may be able to relate to this some, but I come from one income young family. I'm only, I guess about to be 26 here. And, I just have to scrape by just to get my, hunting gear. You know, I got plenty of other stuff that my income needs to go to first. Yeah. And so especially like gym memberships or buying a lot of new gear it's tough to whittle that money away to be doing that. So, if I could, I'd have a membership at like a CrossFit gym, something I knew would kick my butt. Mm-hmm. But, I follow a local CrossFit gym, post their workouts, and I live close to our local high school here in Hyco. And, we can go over there and I'll try to follow those workouts and things. And I've only been doing this now for maybe 2 months and I feel so much more prepared even right now than I did, last year. And then also we're going to be incorporating more stuff, like y'all mentioned on a recent podcast about getting more, sport oriented towards, come later in the summer. And then also we've never done it before, and I think it's pretty new to Texas, but a train to hunt event is going to be here in April, only about 2 hours from us. And so, we're planning on going to that, seeing how that is. And that's kind of our motivation right now, is try to get in shape for that.
Yeah, that's great.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
I was going to say earlier that I like how you said that, being in shape wasn't a key factor in being success, but it made it a lot more enjoyable. And I think that's a good a good viewpoint from it is, do you have to be freaking Cameron Haynes running up and down the mountains to be successful? Absolutely not. But the better shape you are and the more prepared, it's just going to make the hunt and the experience, you know, just that much better.
Right.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And it's not about, like, as you guys found out, you can get burned out the first day. And what I found is, like, being in shape is good for whatever, like on the pack end, it really doesn't matter because you're all amped up. It's like day seven. Like, do you still have anything left into the tank? And as much as, I mean, so much of that's, you know, physical and mental, like mentally, are you prepared? And for me, like the mental aspect of training and going through, you know, moments that suck in my physical training is as much about that mental strength as it is the physical strength. Something you even mentioned was how you realized essentially how mentally weak you were on this trip. Kind of go into that. And then you also mentioned that next year you're going to be more comfortable being uncomfortable. So this whole, like, mental strength, get comfortable with being uncomfortable, like, kind of walk us through some of those lessons learned there.
Okay, absolutely. And I think this is a very important point for anybody like myself that does not live out west and is coming there. And especially like us, if you haven't spent a whole lot of time there besides the occasional like vacation, but actually like in the mountains at elevation, without all the niceties of life, is most of the hunting we do here in Texas is not that intense. In fact, like most of the whitetail hunting I did, a buddy let me set up a stand 5 miles from my house. So it's not that intense. If I get cold,
and you don't
if I
have
get
to hike those 5 miles, right?
I do not. Yep. I can drive about, 200 yards from my stand. And if something gets uncomfortable, I can drive back home. Right. And I think too, like with the romanticizing idea of Western hunting being hard, is that I didn't realize how big of a mental factor there would be. So as soon as I got uncomfortable, it didn't take much for me to start saying, oh man, you know, there was a nice restaurant back at that town we passed, you know, it sure would be nice to go down there and get something to eat, or maybe we should take a break and go get a hotel room one night or something. And especially I ended up, it was my first trip over the counter, do it ourselves in Colorado. And on the third day of our trip, I shot a little bull. And so that was amazing. But especially after we packed that bull out to our truck, that was a just absolutely grueling deal. We actually did it in one trip, which I don't think we'll ever try to do that again. That it just hurt us so bad that really the entire rest of the trip, we didn't hunt that hard. We'd get up on ridges and we'd pretty much say, we have to see an elk way down there or else we're not going.
When, or it has to come,
you know,
to
the first
us
or second
of
day,
it.
We would have jumped off in there.
Right.
And I know also too, for like the day after the night I shot my bull, we had a horrible night on the mountain. We nicknamed it the Hell Night. And that next morning after that experience, hiking back to where we had left our camp where I shot the bull, I remember I was even telling Isaac, we're only halfway through our trip, and I said, dude, next year, how about we'll just get you a tag? Let's just go home right now. You know, my wife has already been texting me saying that she's having a little bit of trouble with our 4-month-old at the time. And I was ready to get off the mountain. I was done. And even though I spent years waiting for that moment, it was surprising how quickly I actually changed and said, I'm ready to get off this mountain. I'm ready to go home. And I was, telling Isaac, you know, saying, hey, we'll make a deal. We'll just get you a tag next year. We'll come hunt for you. Let's just go home now. And things, we ended up sleeping it off and stayed the rest of the week. But like I said, we didn't hunt anywhere near as hard the whole rest of the week, 'cause we were toast.
Yeah.
But
man, that mental game is so huge. And I'll say that it doesn't go away. Like it gets easier. But even like for me, you know, when I'm, you know, thousands of miles away, and like this year, for example, I think it was on the third or fourth day, we pretty much didn't have cell service anywhere, and I got a bit of cell service and talked to my wife, which you think would be very uplifting, but then it was also a time when my kids were home. And when I got off the phone from, like, talking to my 8-year-old, and he was like, "Daddy, are you coming home yet?" And it was, like, only the third or fourth day, I was like, oh my gosh, like, what are we doing? Like, it was one of those times where the hunting was slow, the animals weren't there, you know, we're so far away, and it was like, oh, it would be so easy to walk away. But you just have to stand it and stay mentally engaged and fight through it. And, you know, as it turns out, like, in this hunt, I mean, 3 days later, literally with an hour of daylight left in our week-long hunting, I shot my bull. So that just, like, goes to show you, if you're out there, you're always going to have, like, those moments. But I would say just, like, take that moment for what it is and, like, almost like you said, just sleep on it, because tomorrow you might feel 180 degrees different.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then the where I said that next year I want to be better at being more comfortable, I think that kind of came from something I heard like Tim Burnett say, I'm thinking solo hunter. There were so many moments, especially being somebody, I had a lot of used gear, a lot of very cheap gear. My boots ended up being horrible. The one thing that I spent money on failed me miserably. And my pack, I went with a cheap pack. It's all I could get. Everything through my getting ready for the trip, I thought it'd be okay. Starting out the trip, it was okay. But man, when that weight hit it, with all the meat, it changed. And, even Isaac's pack broke on him on our way back. We had about 1 mile left and his frame started coming out of his. And so I have pictures of him walking down to his back, the last stretch to our truck, and all the meat's just hanging off to one side.
Oh my God.
But he's just so ready to get back. He doesn't even want me to adjust it. He's just going back. But with our change in intensity of what we're trying to do to prepare for next year physically, that I believe has helped me big time, learn to be okay with being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And then also I've had some later hunts this year here in Texas that we've actually had two cold spells, big time cold spells here. And like, I know I was hunting kind of in the panhandle in December, and I've never hunted in temperatures like this. I've never even hunted in the snow, but it was like 8 degrees and snowing, and I was whitetail hunting, and just being able to stick with that, like just saying, no, this is just like the elk hunt. I know I can drive home. I know this is miserable, but I need to teach myself that this is okay.
Mm-hmm.
And to kind of, yes, I want to go home, but this is what I've been waiting for all week at work. This is what I was thinking about. You know, this is, I want to be here and I need to stay here. I try to look for things throughout, and I'm going to throughout this whole year to remind me of that, so that next year, I'll be going with a lot of the same gear. I'm hopefully going to be upgrading my pack this year. Is about the only thing I'm planning on changing. Well, I guess in my boots, but everything else is going to be the same most likely. So there's still going to be some aspects of, if I'm going to do this with some budget gear, I'm not going to be as comfortable as guys that have all the nice stuff. And just knowing that initially, I think will help.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's so good what you said about just taking every moment, like whether that's your late season hunt now or just whatever other opportunity where conditions suck, and just embracing that.
Yep.
I mean, it's almost like you just have to make a game out of it. Like, yeah, it's cold. Yeah, I'm uncomfortable. But guess what? How long can I stay out here? Because I'm not dying. Yeah. I'm not actually getting frostbite. I'm not actually getting hypothermia. I'm fine. I can walk away if something gets serious. So let's just embrace this for what it is and get a little bit tougher. I think it's so good.
Yep.
So I would love to hear on the boots. I'm not asking you to name names. I mean, you can. We don't really care. Because boots, like, the thing is with boots especially is your boots could have been phenomenal boots that someone else is in love with, and they just didn't fit your feet right. Therefore, they weren't good boots for you. I mean, boots are so personal. But did you think going into the hunt that your boots were good? Like, did you, you know, do training hikes and things like them? Like, how are you going to evaluate boots differently now?
So exactly like you said about people's feet being different. I had gotten in my head from listening to another popular podcast that I needed a very stiff boot. And so I went to REI. I bought the bottom of the line Loas that I could get, and I loved them. When I tried them on there, the gentleman there that helped me buy them, even I was going to buy a size smaller, and he even showed me how I needed to buy another size bigger because my toes might hit the front when I'm going down hills and things. And I used them all summer. I used them working some to break them in. We used them on these hikes. I thought they were fantastic. I used them spring turkey hunting in a lot of wet, wet, wet grass, and my feet were dry the whole time. I loved them. So I didn't plan on bringing any sort of backups on the trip. Mm-hmm. If I would have even brought tennis shoes, I probably would have brought out my tennis shoes and gone in those the rest of the trip. But I learned that I'm not sure exactly how this happened and why it happened there and nowhere else, but I really feel like my boots shrunk on me like the second day, to where every time I was going downhill, my toes were jamming in the front. And anytime I was going uphill, my heels were just bearing into that, the stiff heel support of the boot, not really mm-hmm. like a blister type of pain, but just like a bruising type.
Yeah. Like a pressure.
And it just made the hunt miserable. I tried lacing my boots all sorts of different ways that I had seen on videos and things, and nothing would relieve it. And so that was a major factor too, not just our not being prepared enough that we'd like to be last year in our enjoyment of the hunt, but my feet hurt the whole time. And so that just ruins stuff. That's what you're living on out there is your feet. And so next year, I'm actually going to be buying a cheaper boot that Isaac brought and was fine with. And I remember even telling him that, those are too cheap. They're going to fail on you. They're going to be bad. But he loved them and he's still using them. And so I'm probably going to get those next year. And I'm going to bring some sort of backup boot in case those don't work out and leave it in the truck. But that was a crucial point that failed on me on my first trip. And there's a lot of things. I think the reason why I reached out to you in that email is that me coming from my first experience, it's great listening to people who do this all the time and who are experts. Like the only reason I was able to kill an elk this year is because of what I learned from y'all interviewing those type of people. But it was things like that I didn't necessarily know. I didn't know really how altitude was going to affect me. I didn't know. For example, I tried to, there's a lot of people out there talking about, very health conscious, talking about how you need to eat very healthy when you're back in the backcountry. You don't want to be eating, mountain houses and all this other stuff. It's got too much sodium, and how they feel that they don't hunt well or don't feel as well if they're not eating like stuff that they make themselves. So I jumped on board and I said, I got a dehydrator. I'll start trying to do my own stuff. Well, I had no idea that stuff does not dehydrate the same at whatever elevation I am here in Texas and at 11,000 feet. It doesn't. And so most of my meals that I packed that I tested here and were delicious here, like I make some deer spaghetti, some chili, some different noodle things, they literally did not dehydrate at 11,000 feet. I'd even have it in a jet boil for like 20, 30 minutes. And there would still be aspects of it that were hard. Some was soft, and it was horrible. And so then I kept trying to bum Isaac's mountain houses off of him. And so it was just like little things like that, like my feet hurting, my food not being what I planned, my pack not being what I thought it was, slowly added up to me being very uncomfortable.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, when you're out there for days on end and food sucks and your feet hurt, those are by no means little things. Like, that adds up to being horrible.
And then, like, the elevation, I don't know if it was excitement, elevation, or what, but we hardly slept almost the whole time. It was probably not until the fourth or fifth day that we actually slept well. Our first night, I think it was elevation, and we tried to sleep in the back of my truck, which was a terrible idea because it was so cold. We should have just slept on the ground, even though it was wet. Mm-hmm. We hardly slept that night, and we got horrible headaches from the elevation. The second night, we tried to sleep, same deal, back in the truck. And then the next day, we decided to go back into the spot where we had seen a bull on our first day, or a elk, our first day. But he was in a horrible spot. And I actually, when we came out of there our first day, we said, hey, that was cool. There was elk there, but we're not going back because it was too hard. That if there's no way if we killed an animal down there, we could get it back to the truck. Well, I get back to my truck, and it doesn't start. So we had planned on sleeping in that next day, taking a break, and go checking out some other areas, my plant Bs and Cs and so on, before we came back to this spot to see if there was an easier place that we could kill an elk. Well, the truck didn't start. So I said, well, we're here. We might as well go back. So the end of our second day, we decided to hike our way back in there, and we slept in there that night. And we had – the reason we didn't sleep that night was a very good reason. We actually had elk everywhere all night long, bugling so close to us. I would pull out my phone and just record them.
Mm-hmm.
I bet we had a bull. We believe he was the biggest one around. We never actually laid our eyes on him, but for majority of the night, he was about 50 yards from us, just bugling, raking, stomping around in the mud. It was an awesome experience. And we also felt super lucky because I know so many guys that have been doing this that even gave me advice and have hardly even seen an elk on one of these trips, much less heard a bugle. And we were right in the middle of them. So that was pretty neat. But we hardly slept that night. Our third night, the story on that one is we packed elk out. Our partner, the other guys met us, took us to town so I could get my truck fixed. But we decided we could come back a different way and try to get back up there to where our camp was before dark. Well, the long story short of that is those guys were nowhere near as prepared as we were to hike. And in what would have taken me and Isaac half of our time to get up there before dark, we only covered about 3/4 of a mile.
Mm.
So here it is dark. We have 3 miles to go and about 2,200 feet of elevation to go up. And all our gear's still up there because all we did was pack out the meat. I had the little flashlight that was left on my keychain from my truck. We didn't have warm clothes. We did have water, though.
So, all of your gear, like your headlamp, layers. Yeah.
If we could have done it again, we would have realized, hey, it's only about 2 hours till dark. Let's just stay here, make do with whatever we got in the truck and going in the morning. But we thought, no, we can get there.
Yeah.
We got a good trail for about half the way, and then we got to go through the woods for about 2 miles. Well, here we get to the end of this trail. It was probably 11:30 at night, and we realize our flashlights, my battery's dying, and there's no way we're going to go through this thick, dark timber. I mean, there was deadfall everywhere. We just knew if we would have tried to make it to camp, we would have got hurt. And so then we're like, well, okay, so we're 3 miles from the truck. We're 2 miles from our camp. What do we do?
Yeah.
And we got nothing. And so we ended up scrounging up a fire and just laid there around the fire, which for a Texas boy who doesn't ever have to do that all the time. And if you don't know this, it's really hard to light a fire at 10,000 foot. It doesn't stay lit.
Yeah.
And, so we're huddling around this fire, trying to stay warm. We didn't sleep at all that night. It started raining on us because we didn't make it in any sort of cover. We just wanted to be warm. I remember one of the things I did spend money on is I bought some used Sitka clothes. That's one of the things I did have that worked great. But I got holes all in that from the embers from that night being close to the fire.
For being so close, yeah.
So that stuff toast now. And so that night was horrible. We didn't sleep that night either. And so the next morning,
you referred earlier to a hell night. I'm hoping it was this night and you didn't have another that night that was hellish. Okay, good. I was just making sure there was some other crazy story that this was the
that
hell
was
night.
It.
Yeah.
No, it was. I guess if we had been more experienced backcountry hunters, a night like that probably wouldn't have been that bad. But that was so foreign to us, you know. Another thing we're not used to, I mean, both of us feel like we're pretty comfortable out in the woods down here at night, right? Well, where we were staying there, where we were in the mess of the elk, was in the darkest, nastiest timber. It was wet everywhere. It was the creepiest forest in the world. Like, both of us were creeped out the whole time. Like, we loved being there because there was elk everywhere. And most of the time, we'd be almost gagging because it smelled like elk so bad. And we'd be like, this is awesome. But this is the creepiest place on earth.
To spend the night, yeah.
Yeah, and what's also, like, we got noise at night. We got bugs and birds making noise. It was absolutely silent, and that was weird. Yeah. Like, we didn't know about that, and there were so many little things like that that took away from what we were expecting. Yeah. Now, I know probably in this podcast or this interview we've been very negative, but we still...
I wouldn't say you're negative. I would say you're being realistic. No.
Like, we can't wait to go back next year. But when we were packing that elk out and we were about a mile away from the truck, we literally told each other, you know, this was awesome, but maybe this was like a cool thing we did once. Like, we've been there, done that. Let's try something else.
Yeah.
But it's addicting. And all the time, too, when we get back and our whole town was wondering how we did and getting to share some of the elk meat around and always saying, you know, this was the hardest meat I have ever gotten in my life, you know, but it made it all worth it. So
that's awesome.
Hey, Mark, what would be your suggestion on for you guys here, like getting boots and actually testing them before you went? You know, for me, it's easy. If I buy a new pair of boots, I put weight in the pack and go hike 4 or 5 miles up in the mountains.
Yeah.
But how do you do that? You know, Midwest and Texas where it's flat, and I mean, you really need to get on uneven terrain. How do you test that and break them in?
Yeah, I mean, a huge factor there is where you are purchasing the boots and what their return policy looks like. You know, because a ton of places are like, yeah, no problem, you can wear them around the house, but you can't go out and, you know, really get them dirty or show any signs of wear. So, if you're purchasing them from a place like that, I literally load my pack up with weight. And, like, start doing stairs, like, up and down from the basement. Start doing stairs, like, side-footed. Start stepping on stuff that's uneven. Like, start flexing. Like, you know, put your toe up on something higher and see how your heel responds. Does it slide? Does it slip? Does it lock in? So, literally, like, around the house. Again, this is dependent on, you know, that type of return policy. Do those things and do them weighted. And don't just, like I said, do them, like, off-footed and with weird angles and stuff like that. Definitely see how your foot responds to going down. And then I would say try and wear them a lot. Even if this is around the house, try and wear them a lot and just flat out be on your feet a lot. Because I think there's a difference between putting a boot on and walking around for 10 minutes or 15 minutes. But if you can like be on your feet for 2 hours, even if you're just walking around the house, if you can be on your feet for 2 hours, your feet or you know, sometimes even at that point in time, they begin to swell, they begin to change. And so I think that can be incredibly helpful. Now, like some places like REI that you mentioned, they're a bit more liberal in the return policy. And, you know, even if you get out and go outside and they flat out don't work, they can work with you on an exchange or what have you.
If you pay the $20.
Right. Yeah. Like if you're a member. Right. Yeah.
Which I did not do.
Yeah, and in the long run, even if you don't shop at REI, personally, I think it is worth it because it's like a one-time, you're in for life deal, and they do treat you pretty well. And then some REIs, too, also have, like I know that mine does, they have like this big rock formation thing you can crawl around inside to try and go up and down and get on, you know, off-level footing, things like that. So that can be helpful. But yeah, essentially just as much time as you can on your feet. Even if it isn't ideal scenarios, just spend time on your feet and do it with weight. But, I mean, even then, I found, like, it's almost like you said with your trip is, like, what happened to my feet? They were fine. Like, I've just found that my feet feel different some days, which is weird. But, yeah, I mean, it is, I'll be honest, like, that's one of the toughest things to do is to fit boots and to fit them well. And there's good info out there. I think you even mentioned, Matt, there's like different lacing techniques. There's different, you know, strategies, things like that. If you guys are super serious about boots, you know, the listeners, going back to a previous episode, we did an episode with Lathrop and Sons. They're out in the Midwest, but essentially specialize in hunting boots for Western and mountain hunting. And if nothing else, just flat out talk to them because they will provide you with at least a very good starting point. I mean, you can you can go as far as like having them send out stuff to custom mold your feet. Like, I'm not saying you need to go that far. Maybe you can if you have the money to do that. But if nothing else, call them up and talk with them, and they'll be happy to at least help you get started in the right direction. But yeah, it is tough for sure.
Yeah. I think what we went wrong too is I didn't. We were way too mild in how I did test my boots pack.
Yeah, like when you said going for walks on your wife, it's like, or on your wife. God, don't walk on your wife with your boots. Going for walks with your wife. Like, yeah, pushing around the neighborhood, that's time on your feet and good. But yeah, essentially, like, you want to try to get into some terrain. And even just, like, I would say this, for guys who are in the Midwest or out east, and this just isn't about fitting boots. It could be about training. It could be about whatever. There's a hill around you somewhere. And, like, guys get in this mode of, like, oh, I want to go, you know, do a training hike, and I want to try and get elevation. And what they'll do is they'll go hike this 3-mile trail that has, like, one good hill on it. But they'll do the whole 3 miles where most of it's flat and there's one good hill. And what I do, and this is mind-numbingly boring, but go find the biggest, gnarliest hill and just do that. Instead of hiking, you know, 3 or 4 miles for an hour, hour and a half or whatever, just hike that one hill for like an hour or an hour and a half. It's boring, but it's effective.
Yeah.
So if you have to do it, nice. Do it.
Yeah, I would recommend. If I was in Matt in your shoes, I would, do everything Mark said. And then once you decide on a pair of boots, I would go for the longest hike you could think possible, you know, 5 miles, 10 miles, something like that. Because you're going to, we've said it in the last two beginner basic episodes of boots and packs are the two things you don't want to mess with. And it sounds like you got unfortunately unlucky on both of those.
Yeah.
So your pack out, Matt, with the elk, that was like about 4-ish miles. What sounds like somewhere on there?
3.5.
Yeah. 3.5. And it was, from where our truck was, or we had to go, up about 800 or 900 foot. That was the hardest. It was that was probably over a 1/4 mile, maybe. Uh-huh. Like, it was so steep.
Yeah.
We had trouble getting down it, much less going back up it. And there was no good other way around it besides just going straight up. And then it was probably only a few 100 feet here or there for another mile, mile and a half. And then it was downhill about 2,000, 2,500 feet. Mm-hmm. Back down to the truck. And yeah, you know, even though I thought I'd be ready for it by putting, you know, 50 to 100 pounds in my pack every once in a while, you know, I never did anything that was for that long and for that intense.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. not anywhere close, but
yeah,
it was a suffer fest.
So yeah. What went into the decision to pack the elk out in one trip between the two of you?
I guess we thought that
it wasn't going to be as bad as it ended up being.
Yes. Yeah. And then we thought, if it gets bad, well, at least we'll get all of our everything, all the meat we're taking. We'll get at least up that 800 foot.
Yeah.
And then we can drop weight there. Well, then once we got there, we went, that was horrible. And we took a long break, but we thought, you know what? The rest of this will be a lot easier. And then so each section we go on, I guess we kept doing that. And then it got to a point just where we were so miserable, we did not want to turn around to have to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So we just kept with it and kept going. Mm-hmm. But I know like next year when Isaac gets him a bull, we plan on just enjoying that more. We turned it into the worst it could be. And what we feel it could have been. We made it as miserable as it could have been trying to do one pack out. We tried to rush it that my elk died, right in the sun. And so we try to get everything, quartered and off the bone as quick as we could. But now that we think about it, we could have taken more time, and spread it out. We could have done 2 trips. There's a lot of things that next year we plan on doing next year. Should we want to sit down and eat some of it before we even leave, you know, kind of enjoy that little deal, have some tenderloin or something, but we're definitely going to be planning our pack out much different this next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The first elk that my hunting partner and I killed, he shot the bull, and we did the same thing. We packed it out in one trip, and it was really close to 6 miles, like 5.85 or something he had it tracked, and we don't want to do it again. It was pretty brutal. Pretty stinking brutal.
Yeah, I think the trip took us with just our gear going in was about an hour and a half when we put our packs on with the meat and headed back to the truck. It was about a 5.5 hour ordeal.
A little bit.
We were twice as heavy then.
Right. Right.
I was just lucky in my choice of boots, though. They held together and they were everything that I could have wanted them to be. Matter of fact, since then, I now have, I think, three pair.
Yeah.
I have three pair of the same brand.
And what are they, Isaac?
The boots that I took were Salomon. I think they were like a GTX 4 or something like that.
Oh, like the Quest 4D. Yeah.
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 Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's what I wore this past year. Uh-huh.
We were constantly wet and crossing through creeks and through meadows and stuff like that. And with, I think I had some Kintex gaiters, but the inside of my boot, even right now, it looks just as new as it did the day that I bought them. They seemed to wick moisture out from sweat, and they didn't. They never got wet from the outside in.
Mm-hmm. And I passed over those because I don't know, for somewhere I got this idea that they were too cheap, they wouldn't work, and that they would leak like a sieve because they had so much stitching and stuff going on, and that they weren't stiff enough. Well, if I could, listening to even more podcasts since the hunt, shoot, I'd go with a trail runner if I could, if it would work with packing out 100 pounds. But so now I'm trying to wear, I learned that my feet need an extremely flexible boot. I don't want a lot of ankle support. Just the minimum that I need. And so I'm going to be trying the Salomons next year.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great choice. I mean, I run Salomon XA Pro 3Ds and their Ultras, which they're just trail running shoes, and that's what I hunt with, and I absolutely love them. If you can get away with it ankle support wise, I haven't had a blister in I don't know, a decade. I mean, I'm a huge, huge fan of it. I'm not quite sure why everybody thinks you need a really stiff boot and why that perception's out there. I'm sure for some guys it works, but I think the vast majority of guys would be much better off and more comfortable with a more flexible shoe, basically like what Salomon makes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So this is going to be a loaded question, I'm sure, and we're getting far along in the podcast, so we can't spend an hour on it, although I'm sure that we could. But what is – so like – killing the elk, Matt, and you kind of even mentioned podcasts and other resources helped you do that. There's so much information out there in terms of like hunting tactics, tips, calling strategies, like you know, scouting, like you name it. There's so much. But as you look back, what are like two or three things that helped you the most to actually, not backpack, not pack in, not do camp, not do gear, but actually kill an elk?
Actually kill an elk. That would have to be like this podcast thing, like listening to all the people y'all have interviewed. I really enjoyed, I got a subscription to the Elk Hunting University.
Oh, with Corey? Nice.
Yeah, with Corey. A lot of that. I have probably, if you were to pull up my YouTube account and search for archery elk hunting, you'd probably have to go 10 pages before you found one I hadn't watched. So I definitely immersed myself in all sorts of different styles and tactics. Now we definitely had, we were planning on doing it more of Corey Jacobson's style. But I don't know if we just weren't there calling wise or what the lapse was, but in our hunt, we definitely wish we would have been more mild on our bugling. We wished we would have toned that back, used the cow call maybe more, or maybe even not call, picked raking over any calling whatsoever.
I would like to say that Google Earth for Matt, because he was pretty much the navigator. His research and what he found with Google Earth really helped put us in the area where the elk were. Now, that being said, with the experience of have been there and done that and being able to go back at Google Earth and look at the areas that we had gone into, Matt especially is really, can really pick out more or better elk sign on Google Earth now than what we could before. Just being able to, you know, he's really can see what it is that we were looking at, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was at Google Earth. Yeah, really, that had to be the almost, even though it's, I guess, not necessarily a hunting tactic, I feel that are where we are going to go next year, we're honestly placing more of an emphasis on that than almost even how we're going to kill one. Because we learned that, I think it's definitely true, at least in the area we were hunting, there was hunters everywhere. Every trailhead had so many trucks, many people. That first few days, we found a spot to ourselves. And that first spot that I researched very heavily, I did have some backup plans, but that first spot, there was elk everywhere, and I felt so lucky that I was one of the few guys ever that has gone on their first elk hunt, planted themselves, and their first spot is an elk heaven. Like, that's very, very rare. But so what we were able to do the rest of the trip, we went to more mild areas. After we packed out my bull, and we stayed in there a few days, but some other hunters moved in, and we were close to some private land, and all the elk kind of pushed off into the private land. But what I was able to do from when we left the hunt is, in combination of gaining more knowledge, listening to more podcasts, things like that, question and answer videos on YouTube, I was able to seriously look at that area that we found elk in and ask myself, what was it about that one spot that held elk there when everywhere else that we went, we didn't even see hardly any sign of elk. And I've actually learned that, like a lot of the wallows we saw in person, I can see them on Google Earth. And I learned what kind of tree line look that the elk seem to be held in. And then I learned that I think they really like that area because if the pressure did go up, they could scoot off into private land and be safe. So they were comfortable being there until pressure did move them away. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they makes have so much plenty sense.
They have plenty of area to hide. It was there. You could not have snuck up on an elk in this dark timber forest. We were just below tree line. From a very steep incline, and then it kind of, well, I say leveled out, it was still, you know, dropping 400 or 500 feet over about a mile of kind of some rolling stuff, but there was so much deadfall that there's no way you could have snuck up on an elk. So we knew that they were very comfortable being in there because nobody could sneak up on them. They hear you. But they were everywhere. And then I've also found that what you, Steve, and Lenny have talked about, you've answered a few times when people ask, like, if it's okay to camp in the elk. We agree. Like, that is absolutely what happened to us. They did not care. They were all around us. That third morning, we were sitting there waiting on the sun to come up because we had elk bugling everywhere. And that one that spent all night by us just moved right up on this ridge right above us, about 200 yards or so. And we thought, you know what, as soon as it gets shooting light, we'll hammer him with a challenge bugle. And we're in his house. Like, he cannot help but come down here. He's going to have to, right? That's what all the tactics told us. Well, so I moved ahead a little bit. Isaac literally was at our tent. And I was only about 30 yards from where our tent was. And I wanted to get closer, but there were so many cows coming to him and working their way up this ridge, I was pinned down. So finally, Isaac lets out his challenge bugle, and that bull goes silent. I mean, he doesn't say anything else. And next thing I know, I got some movement coming from my left, and I see these two cows coming, and they're about to be right in this tiny little meadow that I'm in. And so I draw back, and they are walking right at me. And then I see I see horns coming behind it, and here comes this little bull right behind them. And I count the points, and I go, okay, he's got four on both sides. He's got five.
Legal. Let's do it.
He's legal. And even though I had a bull that I knew was much bigger, just 200 yards away, kept ringing in the back of my head as all the people I know that do this and don't get something.
For years and years and years, too.
Yes. And so here comes this bull. I mean, my shot was 8 yards. So I've been practicing all summer to shoot 50, 60, 70, even 80 yards. And I got an 8-yard shot straight on. He was walking. He had no idea I was there. One, it was great just to be able to have that happen. And I just go walking back to Isaac, the 30 yards back to our tent. And I said, I just shot a bull. Like, this is crazy. But we did it. But that spot, I put a lot of emphasis on. And also, there was so much country we covered after that we did not find elk in. And I think in that, and I'm not sure this is specific to anywhere else but this area of Colorado, but because I've actually only really found more of these spots in this kind of area of Colorado. But I've been able to figure out what it was. I asked myself, why were those elk there? I went to Google Earth and I found a lot more. And honestly, I found a lot better. So we have spots that we're planning on going next year that I think are, even though I killed a bull in this spot, we're not going back there. I truly believe I have found areas that are even better. Another tool that I think was fantastic, a reason why Google Earth was great, is if I do find some wallows on there, I can scroll through the years and the time frames and see, are those wallows still there? Do they still look active? And that tells me that every year during hunting season, even with pressure, there's still elk here. I've actually, in many spots, I literally have seen elk on Google Earth. Like, so then it's like, well, that's definitely a spot, you know. But that's been a major factor, and especially for planning for next year, is we're going to be focusing more on these spots, getting there, being much more conservative on our calling, probably honestly treating it more like a mule deer hunt, and trying to not let them know we're there, and not try to blow those spots up, because I just think the area we were in, 90% of the elk were in 10% of the country. And
I think tactics too can be wildly successful in one area, one unit, one state, and could be the absolute wrong thing to do in another area, unit, or state. And so it's like, you know, this tactic that guys swear by and that works for them, don't question that at all, but that doesn't mean that tactic is going to work where you are at if you try that. And so especially if you're on the over-the-counter, you know, unit that gets pressured, area that gets pressured, you know, sometimes just shut up, don't call, you know, try and find the elk without it, and then maybe only call once you're, like, truly in the zone if you need to. But, yeah, to be running ridges, blowing bugles, I mean, you know, there's guys that do it well, and it works, but that doesn't mean it's going to work everywhere.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we wish we would have had more tricks in our basket. We kind of focused on just the one strategy last year. So this next year we're going to be, we're still going to have that strategy, the, you know, more Corey Jackson style. We still love that. It looks like the funnest elk hunting ever, but we're going to be trying some others too. And just having more tricks in our bag for next year.
Awesome.
Nice.
So this is, you know, there's listeners out there who I'm sure are getting ready to go on their first hunt, and you've made them incredibly excited. There's listeners who've been on maybe one or two or handful of hunts, and you've made them incredibly angry by going on your first elk hunt and then shooting, you know, an elk 30 yards away from your tent. But, you know, you even mentioned to me that one of your biggest fears before this hunt and with doing all the work, spending the money, driving the distance, leaving the wife, leaving the newborn, was to do all that and not find elk. And I know this is, you know, kind of a theoretical to say because it's not the way it happened, but if you would have done this trip and, you know, been through the hell night and some of the other things that you went through and dealt with the crappy gear and didn't shoot an elk, do you think you would be as hooked as you are now still and want to go back? Do you think it would be worth it? I guess for, you know, for listeners who are out there who are like, is this worth it? What's your thoughts?
I think if I didn't kill a bull, just seeing the elk, that was my goal. I said that I felt confident enough in my hunting abilities, even though I've never done this type of hunting before. Just being adversed in the woods and a bow archery hunting and things, that if I could just hear some bugles, if an elk would just tell me where it is, or if I could see one, then I feel like I could do okay. So if I wouldn't have seen one, then yeah, I would be seriously questioning, was this worth all the stress in our lives for putting money into this instead of other places, putting all this time, putting my wife through a week and a half of just her being with a not sleeping baby. You know, that would have been a lot tougher. But I'm not sure exactly why, but I'm assuming that whole idea of am I going to find elk is what makes us new hunters, new Western hunters, the most nervous. I mean, it kept me up at night. I'd be sitting there. I'd tell Isaac, hey, I'm really excited about this spot and here's why. But as soon as I'd hang up on the phone with him before the hunt, I would say, but gosh, I hope it's really what I think it is. Or any of these other spots for that matter, what I think it is. Cause if we do all of this and I don't even see an elk, cause I heard so many horror stories of these guys doing that, yeah, it could have affected my want to do it again. I don't think killing an elk, though, makes me want to go again. But if I went the whole week without seeing one, it definitely could have affected my desire to do it again.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Awesome. Perfect. Well, we're coming up on time. Is there anything sticking out that you would want, you know, somebody else who was in your shoes a year ago to hear? From your experience or anything that we didn't cover? I mean, we covered a lot and I think a ton that's incredibly helpful, but did we sort of miss anything that you want to cover before we wrap this one up?
I don't think so. I think most importantly is just is prepare and prepare more. And if whatever you're doing to prepare isn't killing you, then it may not be enough because your hunt will, you know, try to be, especially if you're like us and this is a very foreign thing, even though you're excited about it, going into the mountains at high elevation hunting an animal you've hardly been around is very foreign. Be ready to be uncomfortable and out of place. Be ready to have your plans stomped on and you get a feeling like, oh gosh, like I don't know what to do now. My whole plans are thrown out the window. Just be ready for that and be ready to have your plan B and C close by and stick to them. Don't be discouraged. And just know that it is absolutely doable. We did it. And I mean, maybe an experienced hunter might be looking at me and saying, you know, don't be ridiculous, but I can't even tell you how confident I am going into next year. And that's not because I killed a bull, but it's Isaac is up first next year. I'm so gung ho for getting him a bull, and I've done all this research, done even more work, and we really think it's going to happen if luck's on our side. But this is one of the greatest experiences and the hardest experiences I've ever been through, and it was fantastic. So everybody should definitely try it.
Yeah. Very rewarding. I think all the work, all the blood, sweat, and tears, and everything that was put into it all, and just thankfully, you know, we come back with the prize, and it just, I mean, every time I take a bite of that meat, you know, at dinner with the family, I mean, it's just that much better.
Mm-hmm. Right. I love your guys' confidence going into next year, because I think it's such an important aspect that's overlooked, is that confidence is just going to, you know, you're just going to hunt better, you're going to hunt smarter, and when things do get tough, your mental attitude is going to be a lot better about the situation, and and you'll keep at it, and you're going to end up being tagged out.
Yep. Yeah. That's awesome. Well, Matt, Isaac, we're proud of you. Can't wait to hear how it happens next year for you, and thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Yeah, thank you. We love sharing our experience. So,
thank you for listening to the Hunt Backcountry podcast. To access the show notes for this episode and subscribe to future episodes, please visit exomountaingear.com/podcast. We value your feedback and would love to hear about any questions, topics, suggestions, or comments you have. Our email address is podcast@exomountaingear.com. Additionally, if you're enjoying the show, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes. By doing so, you will be entered into our next Exo Mountain Gear swag giveaway. We look forward to the next episode and hope you do as well.